reflecting on the ending of our second full day and night together. Beautiful full moon rising. This cultivation of the path of awakening is quite a journey, a challenging journey. But as someone who inspired us a lot, as Ram Dass used to say, it's the only dance there is. Once we realize the damage and danger of living unconsciously, then we try to do the best we can to return, to connect, to keep beginning again. This rising of the full moon has lots of sanya, perceptions, memories for me in the Buddhist tradition. Many of you, maybe most of you, know these full moon occasions. Not only Buddhist, but also pre-Buddhist are potentized occasions for remembering why we're doing all this. In the Buddhist tradition, they're called the Upasata days, the full moon, then the waning half moon, then the new moon, then the waxing half moon. Those approximately once a week, but these phases of the moon, these rhythms of nature which we're part of. One can recognize when the moon is full. One can recognize when it begins to wane, become a half moon. One can recognize when it's gone. It's a dark sky. Then allows the starlight to shine more brightly. And the appearance of the moon again, the waxing moon. But these were occasions where the Buddha encouraged us to take stock. Remember our intention. What is our intention? Why do we practice? Each of us to formulate in our own hearts, not a right answer. Why are we doing it? And to remember that intention. And to remember that without some sort of faith, some sort of trust, practice is impossible. We have to have everything proven to us. We'd never take the first step. But all of us do share some trust. We wouldn't be coming on a retreat, a meditation retreat. We somehow trust that the Buddha was pointing to something that's real. The saints and sages were pointing to something that is real, that there is such a thing as waking up. That there is a possibility of seeing through our confusion and accessing a profundity of wisdom and compassion, this capacity from that deep place of understanding to recognize and respond to and make a difference, alleviate suffering from that place of clarity, from that place of open-heartedness. And the Buddha taught that actually when he was awake, he didn't acquire anything. That he knew that was subtle. But he realized, he realized, woke up to an already, always already present, Amatta Dhamma, undying Dhamma, which is here and now, suffusing all experience with its radiance. What he called the Tathagata Garbha, the womb of the Thus Come Ones, the mother of all Buddhas, comes out of this ground. That all beings share this original brightness, merge in this ground, but that we become refugees from our own sacred core when we get confused and attached to this karmic configuration, this identification, and that out of that confusion then emerges birth and death and suffering and conflict and all sorts of causes for suffering. He taught a path of challenging that basic motion of grasping, identifying, owning. Taught a path of sharing, connecting, realizing our interconnectedness. He taught a path of restraint, not sharing some things. When there's that impulse to harm, he taught not to share that, but to bear it, feel it, permeate it with investigation, understanding. Told us not to share, not to give when we're wanting to take, possess, especially that which doesn't really belong to us. So all the precepts, and that can be counterintuitive when sometimes it looks like we just knock out of the way what we don't want, get a hold of what we want. But the Buddha is teaching, trust me. This restraint is honoring the sacred nature of all that breathes, all that lives, because truly we are brothers and sisters, because we merge from this same tree of life. We come from this same source. We taught these meditative journeys to help us return. The full moon reminds me of in our monastic life for the first, for me, 15 years. Every apposita day, we would sit up all night. That's challenging. But I entered the monastery at 24, so from 34 to about 39, that was pretty much every week. Except there was 3 years I had to lie down when I was really sick, so I couldn't sit up all night then. But I remember so often, going into these the beginning of the all-night sitting, the moon is rising, the young enthusiasm, I'm going to conquer it, I'm going to break through. It's beautiful to have that motivation to stay with. Being with the breathing, being with sensation, recognizing the that which can, when it's not appreciated, hinder us, the desire and the aversion, the doubts, exhaustion, the agitation. And you know, so often I would, you know, start the night, you know, determined. And the stories they have them, you know, sitting all night like a rock. Invariably after, you know, 32 minutes or something. have to change posture, and then before you know it, you're there and you're realizing you almost just fell off the platform. And you can start to worry. If you have a nose like mine, that's a significant nose. You measure the number of feet off the platform you're sitting in, if it goes down that nose into concrete, that would be quick death. But you know, and then see other people nodding in your moments of wake, you think, well, I'm not doing too bad, and then it's you nodding. But I'm so grateful that we were taught persistence, but we were also taught patience, and also taught kindness, the kind of kindness that's not what I was touching on this morning, is not pretending to like everything, but a brahmavihara, a noble abiding of not adding aversion to the mix. If there's aversion there, not adding more aversion. To keep allowing. Keep welcoming. Keep trusting that there's an alchemy. That there's something that's happening. And invariably, with all the frustrations and disappointments and trying and collapsing and at times, rather than clarity, the mind's just an alphabet soup of stuff. But invariably, I found by the dawn, the light element starting to increase again, and that shining moon is starting to set. And one is almost like being through a tumble dryer. Being on retreat can be like going through a tumble dryer, or a washing machine, or but all that struggle and trying and failing and beginning again, there was a surrender. And when we would, at the dawn, then get our bowls and then walk out of the forest into the villages as the town was waking up. Oftentimes some of the villagers, because we were in a wonderful poor rural part of Thailand where a lot of the villagers had faith in the Buddha, they would sit with us. And especially the women, they would sit like rocks. They were incredible. But having been through that night, there was a possibility then of when not pushing, not pulling, just being there. Not complicating the moments with all sorts of expectations, demands, wonderings. Everything had beauty. Everything was beautiful. The exhaustion was beautiful. The dawn was beautiful. The support of ground had its beauty. The joy could be called just the joy of being. Joy of recognizing all that stuff, manifesting, screaming, the cries of the world. These are, when Kuan Yin listens at ease to the cries of the world, as we're practicing internally, externally, we're in training to bear, to be able to bear and feel and metabolize the cries of the world. And one has the possibility of touching into that dimension that is infusing it all with vitality. That dimension that knows, that's aware. Before I read what the Buddha said, the image that reminded me, I realized while I had an image, it's a bit simple, when I was even growing up in school, I was a very diligent student, wanted to be the best, and all these things we had to learn were written on the board, and then with the chalk and this and that, and we would memorize it and then practice it with Dad. He would test us on our math skills, how quick we could do the numbers, the additions, subtractions, divisions. But what I loved was in the morning, there was always this relief to be able to see that that board that could be so complicated. It was washed clean. It was empty, but filled with incredible possibility, that empty heart that is a space for magic, for everything to manifest and shift and change. It was a bit like that at the end of those all-night sittings. In a famous teaching that the Buddha gave in the Sharangama Sutra, a wonderful Chinese, it's really prominent, Master Shunhuar, Chinese master, pointed to this sutra as very important in understanding samadhi, and we'll talk about this later. But there's a quote in the sutra where the Buddha is speaking. Sharangama means durable. It's pointing to that samadhi, that abiding that can't be harmed, that is unshakable. One of the definitions of sacred is it's unassailable. The unassailable, the unshakable, the truly durable, the truly essential. In the Sharangama Sutra, one of the statements the Buddha said is the primary misconception about the mind and body is the false view that the mind dwells in the physical body. You do not know that the physical body, as well as the mountains, the rivers, empty space, and the great earth are all within the wonderful, bright, true mind. Can be this view, no, excuse me, Kiddushar, but that's not scientific. Consciousness is a chemical byproduct. It's a chemical byproduct. But it's just interesting. The Buddha says, primary misconception about the mind and body is this mistaken, this false view that the mind dwells in the physical body. It sometimes feels like we're inside the skull. We're locked inside this form, this skin, this frame, this mood, this affliction. You do not know, he says, that this physical body, and I'm sure we could add the moods, the afflictions, as well as the mountains, the rivers, empty space, and the great earth are all within the wonderful, bright, true mind. This body right now, experience of sitting here together, what we're feeling. It's manifesting. We're learning to recognize that it's appearing. What's it appearing to? The memory of eating supper is a memory now. Those of us who had the lovely soup, mushroom soup, blessing of food, whatever else we have, memory, what's going to happen later tonight, what's going to happen tomorrow, what's going to happen to the country, what's going to happen to the world. I don't know. We don't know. What's happening now? We can see the memories, the concern about what's going to happen, but these body, these sensations are happening, appearing within this consciousness. We might think we're moving through the retreat, but actually the retreat is manifesting moment after moment in this heart of ours. The Buddha was from the warrior caste, but he, and that part of that inheritance, I think, is very important. We don't want to just demonize the warriors. Yes, warriors that fight to harm, just get lost in domination. But the faculty that stood the Buddha so well was that perseverance, that staying with, and then later that sense of a guardian. A guardian who has concern, compassionate concern. He considered all beings his children that were caught in a burning house. And he wanted to find ways to guide them, coax them skillfully out of that burning house of birth and death and suffering that kept perpetuating itself through greed, hatred, and delusion. But a certain persistence is really helpful. And in our training, where this persistence will help us. But we can't, as Master Hua used to say, you can't drink the ocean in one gulp. Or Ajahn Chah would tell us, he had very earthy images. He would say, don't pretend you have a 10-wheeler truck when you have a wheelbarrow. No, he didn't say your capacity can increase. But we, each of us, we have to trust our own body, mind, our own intuition, beginning again to sense what we can do. And this principle of samadhi is so helpful. He talked about why, what are the uses of this samadhi? The first use of this training. He said it's very important to learn. He didn't say your yearnings and distress with regard to the world are just wrong. He didn't say that. There is a lot to be distressed about. There's a lot to yearn for. A compassion yearning to make a difference is considered compassion. It's skillful. But he also taught that it's skillful to be able to have the agility to be able in moments to let that be, to learn how to subdue that for the sake of unification. What was the first use of unification? He said, to learn to cultivate and access a pleasant abiding in the here and now. It's the healing dimension of meditation. It allows us to restore, to take a holiday, a true holiday, a holy day. Another definition of sacred is holy. And holy, H-O-L-I, comes from a root whole. One of the definitions, the way the Buddha talked about samadhi, is learning to come together. There's a unification. We gather, just like the trees And many of them in wintertime drop the leaves and gather as we're moving more into autumn and then winter. Gather strength that then gives rise to the wonderful springing forth of new life. In the time of the Buddha, he went on retreat. I don't know if he needed it or not, but he set an example that this is really helpful for us to go deeper, to restore, to get into perspective. He also taught that this samadhi is for knowledge and vision. The more we learn how to be composed in the moment, the more, in terms of a very refined knowledge and vision, that means when samadhi is really cultivated, the saints and sages, Buddha talks about being able to intuitively know things. To know one's past lives, to be able to sense the minds of others, to be able to do extraordinary things. But even if we're not able to levitate and see past lives, when we're more composed, whatever the mind turns to, information about that, direct information will come up. Our intuition will deepen, not just by what someone else said. When we're composed and then we turn to a circumstance, a situation, it can be a fresh look. That's why on retreats sometimes we can have so many ideas, perspectives. Or patient. Also, a use for samadhi, he says, is the mindfulness and alertness. In other words, the more we develop this capacity to compose ourselves, then it allows us to be more present for our lives. So that we're not just on automatic, we're connected. But the final and most profound, very profound, use of samadhi is that it liberates us from the outflows. What are the outflows? These floods, they're called asavas. They carry us. Our views, dittasava, kamasava, the idea of wanting just to hold on to that which is pleasing in the sense world. I mean, it's natural because pain is no fun. The idea if we could just hold on to what is pleasing. But as we all know, that can't do it. Wouldn't it be nice if the moon was always full? Wouldn't it be nice if things were always pleasant? Wouldn't it be nice if everyone was always in harmony? It just, things change. Kamasava, Bhavasava, Ditasava, Vijasava. Just we're swept out by wanting to become something, swept out by aversion, swept out by delusion, and then we lose touch with this original brightness, this core. So ultimately, as the retreat goes on, we will use some of our accumulator. We might not feel it, but we're little by little just going through this process together. Our samadhi is building up. Our capacity to bear the changing states, to find this ground of bodily presence, however we're using it. And I just really encourage us to trust the value of cultivating this agility. When we do let go of our longings and distress, that doesn't mean to say we're letting it go forever. We're learning in moments It's called viveka, to turn the mind to dwell with the body, using the breath, using the breathing. To reveal this heart of ours so that we're not just captivated by external states, that we're learning to discover this quality of citta, this quality of heart. And that when our energy is not being so sprayed and scattered by going this way and going that way, and we're learning to, in this moment, say, how is it now? And to use sound, or however we do it, to use kindness, to first learn to just not get caught up in fighting and rejection, and be able to use this rhythm of breathing, of refreshing, of calming, of steadying. Buddha talks about this long breath to refresh and calm. Then he talks about being with the short breath. That means that as we were taught, that at a certain point, being with the body, there's a certain part of being with the body that's easier for us. It might be at the nostrils. Our teacher Ajahn Chah found it very helpful to be there. Some of us might prefer being with the rising and falling of the heart. Some of us it's easier for the belly, swelling and subsiding. Or for some, just a general sense of the body breathing. But just learning to have an immediate, direct reflection of connecting with life, of just being what's called the short breath, because we're just being with the vibration, the subtle breath in that one place. Like standing by the sea and having the waves come in and go out. Just witnesses the in-breath and the out-breath in one place, that sensation. And to be able to use a phrase, a word, shortened, moderated, like Buddha, the name of the Buddha, that's what they use in Thailand. Breathing in Buddha, breathing out To. It just means awake. It just reminds us. Or even a word like in and out. Just to remind us to be here, to keep us on track. And then, so for a time, another thing comes in that wants us to think about this and wants us to think about that. We're not rejecting it, but we're just saying, not now. I'm restoring. I am finding the well that will infuse my life again with resilience and brightness and connection to ground, to source. And being able to then encourage us to then receive and connect to this moment and touch into what's called pitti. The Buddha wants us to develop some capacity for joy. He said that's one of the factors of enlightenment. There can be sometimes so much that is wrong, we can maybe feel we don't deserve it. That was just life-changing for me. To realize that there is a natural quality of, and that's natural, of joy that can well up, that we can cultivate, that can be right here, to in this moment, just by receiving whatever the sensations in the body are, even if they're tired. We can be interested and hold those and savor them as we breathe in and out. A quiet joy of just being awake, of being able to, even in a moment, allow the energy of that breath as it brightens us on the in-breath, on the out-breath. We relax and feel some sukha, ease. Just to be here now. And as that capacity even to be with the short breath in one part, then the Buddha encourages us to little by little learn to widen widen the awareness. That's the healing part. Some of you know I had a history almost of died of typhoid fever in my early years in Thailand, and then for many years I was sick. Constant pain, internal bleeding. The doctors couldn't do much about it after I got over the typhoid. I spent 3 years lying down, almost all lying down, because I had to get up to try to go to the bathroom. But this practice of learning to widen the awareness to include the whole body, just to breathe in and out. And each out-breath I would surrender to Mother Earth. So grateful places to lie down. You just give me any little square, any little dingy room, if I could lie down. When one lies down, one is then held by ground. The out-breath, Buddha encouraged us how to use that out-breath for surrender, letting be and feeling that support, just as Mother Earth supports the body. So too the mind can gently rest with the body and steady itself. Each out-breath, relaxing. Each in-breath, a little blessing of vitality from the magic of the cosmos. And then one, because I had all this inflammation, internal bleeding, pain, wherever was painful would call attention. That's its function. So as one breathes, rather than panicking about pain, an important training, the Buddha says, pleasure and pain are natural. We need them. Pain reminds us of something that needs attention. So then that pain would call me. Then as I breathe into that painful area, and then breathing out, widening, softening, allowing that subtle breath energy from that very breath then to mingle with that tissue and the surrounding tissue. And then one then notices, because remember, instead of consciousness being inside the body, the rivers, the mountains, the great earth herself are all within the wonderful, bright, true mind. So when one widens and notices the whole body, the body is inside the mind. Then the different parts of the body start to communicate with each other. The body's in the mind, the connection with body-mind deepens. And then the different parts of the body, as we breathe in and out and soften and relax, the different elements then can balance. The Buddha talks about this process with a simile. He's talking about the first jhana. The first natural state, jhana, just means a state of being, of stability, plugged in. It's called absorption. It's when it's a steady state. Here's how he talks about it. Having abandoned the five hindrances, when for a moment we put them aside, wanting something, not wanting something, being drowsy, the moment when we're not drowsy, when we're not just agitated. So we brighten the drowsiness, a little bit calm the agitation. When we're not just caught in worry and uncertainty. So if we abandon or move toward that, secluded from sense pleasures, just looking for something out, secluded from unwholesome state, the practitioner enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by vitakka vichara. That means that directed thought. So that first state of peace has some thought in it. It's a quiet bomb. It has fall and what's called examination here. It's not that you're taking an exam, but it's that part of the mind that feels into. It points back and feels into. So the mind is playing with the body. It can be that first jhana, can be even with a thought. Breathing in, breathing out. Or kwan, in. Or steady, steady. That doesn't interfere with the thought, is sure. It dissolves. It just reminds us to be present and reminds the mind to feel into and explore the sensations. That's what's meant by thought and examination. The practitioner enters and dwells in this first abiding jhana, which is accompanied by applied thought and examination or exploring. With rapture and happiness, born of that seclusion. That energy, when we pull our mind, even for a moment, back to obsessive being caught in the longing and distress with regard to the world, we just even let it go for a little time. That seclusion, all that extra energy that was going out, guess what? It starts emerging inside the heart itself. Rapture and happiness born of that seclusion. The practitioner makes that rapture and happiness born of the seclusion drench, steep, fill, pervade this body so that there is no part of the whole body that is not pervaded by this pitti sukha, this joy and happiness born of seclusion. Here's the simile, just as a skilled bathman heaps bath powder in a brass basin, sprinkling it gradually with water, kneads it until the moisture wets the ball of bath powder, soaks it, pervades it inside and out, and yet the ball itself does not drip. All that moisture pervades and there's a transmutation that happens. Soaks and pervades it, says the Buddha, inside and out. But the ball does not drip out. This practitioner, this monk, this nun, makes this rapture and happiness born of seclusion, drinks deep, fill, and pervade the whole body, so that no part of the whole body is not pervaded by that happiness. Born of this viveka, born of this moment of letting go. And again, and then here's the next image for this next abiding that we can touch into. With the subsiding of thought and examination, there's a certain point when we don't have to tell ourselves to be present. When the mind gets quiet, we're not reminding ourselves to be here because we're here. With the subsiding of this thought, practitioner dwells in the second jhana, which is internal confidence and unification of the heart. It's without thought and examination. It has rapture and happiness born of this concentration. The practitioner makes that pitti sukha, born of that samadhi, drench, steep, feel, pervade this body so that there's no part of the whole body that's not pervaded by that rapture and ease born of concentration. Here's the image. Just as a lake whose waters welled up from below and it had no inflow from the east, west, north, or south. And it's not replenished from rain, but the cool font of water is welling up in the lake. This cool water drenches, steeps, fills, and pervades the lake so that no part of the whole lake is not pervaded by that cool water. So too does the practitioner allow this happiness and joy, born of concentration, drench, steep, fill the whole body, We don't need to be afraid of the possibility of moments of joy. We don't have to look too far away. And allow this body, out of compassion, to take time to allow ourselves to withdraw and just with kindness envelop this body-mind. Receive that gift of the in-breath and out-breath. Deeper breath, refreshing, calming, and steadying, widening, and then allowing that alchemy to happen. Calming. And to hold it very lightly then as we widen and any little feeling of enjoyment. Like if there's no big desire right now, no big aversion right now, can we rejoice at this mind that can be present and relax and allow that energy to bless this body. And as we breathe out and just rest in that kindness, that presence, can we allow that energy to emanate? On this full moon night, the Buddha is here. These qualities of kindness, compassion, patience, joy, ease are not somewhere else. They're treasures within this heart. When a monk got so attached to the Buddha and the Buddha sent him away, he was distraught. The Buddha said, "Why are you distraught?" He said, "You sent me away." And the Buddha said, pointing to his body, "This is not the Buddha. When we see the Dhamma, that's when we really meet the Buddha. So we, working with this very heart, this very awareness, a chance to walk that ancient path and align with and merge with all living beings." So encouraging us to take heart and use our time well. Thank you for giving of yourselves on this arduous journey. May we stay with it. Allow the alchemy to happen for the welfare of all.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.